From UFOs to psychic powers and government conspiracies, history is riddled with unexplained events. You can turn back now, or learn the stuff they don't want you to know.
Well, hello, and welcome back to the Ministry of Stuff They Don't Want You to Know. They call me Matt.
And I am Noel, the Illuminated One Brown.
Shamanamana, Shamanamana, Mamanamana.
You doing that scene from Temple of Doom?
I was momentarily speaking in tongues. Forgive me.
I was covering my heart over here, man.
I think that's just saying Kali Ma, and then you're supposed to say Om Nam Shabai.
Oh.
Isn't that right?
Oh, yeah, I guess so.
Om Nam Shabai. Om Nam Shabai.
Oh, that's right.
From Temple of Doom.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Kali Ma!
Well, we're talking about a different kind of temple today, aren't we?
There we go.
Not necessarily one of Doom, but, you know, potentially.
Yeah, they call me Ben, you are you. This is not the Indiana Jones Temple of Doom tribute show. This is stuff they don't want you to know. And Noel, your segue was fantastic. What are we talking about today?
Today we're talking about a little something called prosperity theology, or I guess we could also think of it as televangelism.
Yeah, so that's certainly an arm. Yeah, it's an arm of it.
Yeah. So here we go. Another religious episode. It's not particularly religious. We're not talking about a religion so much as we're examining some of the people operate it within it and a movement, the U.S., that you have maybe heard about. And, yeah, I think televangelism absolutely ties into this. We hear the phrase evangelist, but what does that mean? It's a person who seeks to convert other people to a certain faith. It is also known as proselytizing. It's typically used in a Christian context. Here in the West, you know, we don't hear much about Buddhist evangelists. So we don't even know if that's a thing. So the connotation here involves public speaking and or performance. So while our super producer Casey Pegram for today.
We just have a stable of super producers these days. we are in the money.
A posse of a super posse of super producers in a stable. So we'll pick on Casey a little bit and use him as an example. If Casey was proselytizing people, he might just decide to write a letter. You know what I mean? Like, I'll just pick someone random. Dear Al Franken.
Mm-hmm.
Or Donald Trump or whomever. I sincerely believe in this particular thing, and I think you should too, you know. And it could be any sort of spiritual idea.
Yeah. So it's a solicitation, basically.
Yeah, it's a solicitation in that regard. And that's probably a very polite letter because Casey is a very talented writer.
Yeah, we just had DragonCon here, and you'll always see at least something that I see every year during DragonCon are evangelists – who are proselytizing in the streets with big signs, you know, talking about Christianity and come to Jesus and all of that. It's a thing you've probably seen.
Yeah.
They were a little lazier this year. I saw one dude that just had a boombox that was playing a message on loop, and he just stood there holding the sign.
Well, he's there all weekend.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's hard work. You can't sit down.
Maybe right? It was lunch break or something.
Yeah.
That seemed a little phoned in to me.
I wish there was a Yelp for a street corner protest. That would be great. So evangelism is a little bit more in your face. That's the connotation. Were Casey practicing a type of proselytization called evangelism, he would maybe go the whole nine, you know, a linen suit, a tent that travels across the Sun Belt, super producer Casey Pegram's powerhouse of signs, wonders, and deliverance. I'm actually selling myself on this. What do you think, Casey? Okay, yeah. We got a thumbs up.
Yeah, I would go to that.
And you're familiar with this in fiction, and you're familiar with this with the televised version of it, which are called televangelists. Right?
Great example would be in the show Carnival. There is a whole traveling preacher scenario where they set up a tent, and you know people speak in tongues, and sometimes get the Holy Spirit in them, just laying hands, and all of that. A lot of that old school kind of showmanship that goes into this idea of evangelism.
Yeah, and I also remember one of my favorite creepy versions of it is the tent revival preacher in True Detective season one, who has this rambling monologue that is super Lovecraftian and sinister, but people are treating it as though, you know, they were in a listening to a sermon on the gospel.
And isn't that just one appearance of that guy? Like, is that it?
I think he comes back, but he's very briefly. You never see him
it's
preaching.
It's like a tone
again.
Setter more than anything, yeah, but boy, does it ever set that doom.
He sees your true face.
Yeah.
He sees it.
Reminds me of when I saw Third Eye Blind, and he's talking about seeing people's true faces, the singer. And he says, you know what? I want to see your true face. And when I see him, you know what they're going to be saying? They're going to say, F yeah.
Whoa.
Turns out it's a bit he does. It's a little bit of a street preacher kind of vibe.
Nice.
So he is perhaps also proselytizing for the Church of Third Eye Blind. The term evangelism derives from biblical sources in our modern connotation. It started as a Greek word. It originally meant something like messenger of good news, which is why you would hear people say, have you heard the good news?
And that's all about Jesus died for your sins and came back, and if you believe in him, then you get to go to heaven. That's the good news.
Or it's a Geico commercial.
Okay. It's possible.
It's just we live in a weird time, right?
Yeah.
So we've got evangelical Christianity, right? You'll often hear evangelism assigned to that. And so, for instance, there could be a Methodist evangelist, right?
Mm-hmm.
There could be any degree of Protestant. They've got several doctrinal things in common. One of the biggest, of course, is the emphasis on the born-again nature of religious salvation.
Yes.
Right?
And here in the United States, we've had really a special relationship with evangelism. It's just thrived here in this country.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, across the world as well, but here I would say, at least from my research and what I've seen, it just thrives.
Why do you think that is?
That's a great question. I think maybe it's just where – I don't know. Maybe it matches up with the American dream in some way.
Yeah.
Or
the idea of rebirth perhaps?
Yeah. I don't know.
I feel like I can culturally tie it into some things. But
yeah.
I feel like there's a reason that America is such rich cultural soil for this sort of stuff. But this is expanded now across the world.
Mm-hmm.
Wherever there are Protestants, there are also going to be evangelical organizations.
Big time. And a huge political movement, I suppose you could call it, mm-hmm. or at least a big driver of political change
sure.
in the Republican Party specifically.
Yeah. And in also there's – I don't want to leave the Catholic Church out. The thing we have to remember, which may strike some of us who are more secular as surprising, is that although multiple denominations of a given religion exist, in this case Christianity, within those denominations there are movements, right? And
mm-hmm.
those movements, as Noel said, can often drastically affect the political landscape in Central America. And in South America, there was a movement called Liberation Theology, which totally struck the more hawkish right wing part of the American government as a threat, because there are these left wing Catholic priests who are saying, well, this is how we think Christianity should be applied toward a more socialist environment, which is, you know, a big no-no. It's a big invitation mm-hmm. to the U.S. to meddle in a country's affairs. But yeah, these genres, or maybe denominations, movements is probably the best word, are not always created equally. Like some individual evangelical preachers have reached the pinnacle of stardom and success. You know, Casey Pegram's powerhouse of signs, wonders, and what was the other one? It's a long name.
Yeah.
We shouldn't have made it such a long name. And some movements blossom only to enter a decline in later years. One especially prominent here in the U.S. and controversial type of Christian belief system is known as prosperity theology. You might not have heard the term before, but you have definitely heard of the women and men preaching it.
We said it at the top of the show.
Yes.
So hopefully they've heard it at least once.
Yes.
Hopefully you've heard it at least once. Wait, what's the idea here?
So the idea here is that God – what God wants for you is to be well, like to be healthy, and to be financially blessed. God wants that for you. The problem is with you. It's with your faith. you don't have enough faith. You've got to have that. You've got to you have to send money and donations to these places to essentially increase your faith in a way. Like, I'm going to give this money in faith to a ministry, and then I am going to receive something back from that. I'm going to get my stuff back tenfold from God, my blessings.
Or at least that's according to the leaders of these particular denominations. Right, Ben?
Yeah. So this is the idea. I think that's a good summation there, Matt. The idea is that personal faith, what's called positive speech or positive confession, and donations to religious causes will be repaid in material and literal terms, right? As well as spiritual.
So it's not just karma. It's like cash.
Yeah, 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 exactly. And the Bible is portrayed in a lot of prosperity theology as a contract between God and humans. Very if-then proposition. If humans have faith in God, God will deliver security and prosperity. Sickness and poverty, interestingly enough, are viewed as curses that can be broken by the power of faith, sort of the power of positive thinking. And what a lot of people may be surprised to learn about this movement is that it's built on a secular concept.
The Secret, basically.
Yeah, it's built on a concept that The Secret also borrows from, called New Thought. And it's popular in the late 19th, early 20th century, and it was pretty much, yeah, the modern interpretation would be The Secret.
What's The Secret?
That's the thing that it's all about New Thought. It was a book that was written that essentially says you put positive thoughts out into the world and you can make them real. Anything that you truly believe, you can make happen, essentially.
Which, again, is a later interpretation of the original New Thought thing, right? Mm-hmm. From the late 1800s. So The Secret doesn't repackage this for a long time.
Yeah.
I just remember seeing that book everywhere, and I've never had any idea what it was about.
It's because Oprah mentioned it.
Oh, okay. Yeah,
because Oprah Winfrey said it. Well, the idea, the philosophy behind New Thought was that the key to health and wealth acquisition is thinking, visualizing, and speaking the right words. And not all of the New Thought proponents or fans were Christian, but they all generally held that the individual human being had a divinity and that they could affect physical change through their mental state, mind over matter.
It's like the power of positive thinking.
Exactly. And that's what The Secret is.
Got it.
More or less. I hope we didn't ruin the book for you.
Can you spoil a book like that?
Kind of. You're supposed to buy it. That's the whole point of the book.
Yeah, but I mean, surely reading
reading
it will give you more benefit than just hearing us, you know, give the cliff notes.
Well, you could buy it, or you could just think positively that it's already in your house. Let me know what happens.
Or just imagine and visualize that you've already read it.
Now, I know I'm not I don't mean to sound rude. There are quantitative studies that prove at least the medical effects of positive thinking, mm-hmm, in terms of recuperation rates, stuff like that.
But we're talking mind control here.
Right. In other words, if you could correctly channel your mental energy, you could harness material results almost, very quickly. Mm-hmm. A man named Norman Vincent Peale was pastor of a place called Marble Collegiate Church in New York City, and he popularized this idea and these techniques in America with his book, The Power of Positive Thinking, which I know you've heard of. It's a real book.
Yeah. Whoa.
1952.
I could have written that book. I just came up with that name a minute ago.
My friend's mom had that book on her shelf when I was in middle school. I remember
seeing
it.
Is it a good read?
I never touched it.
Oh, they wouldn't let you touch it?
No, I remember
it like being enshrined in glass on the mantle?
No, I could just see it sitting there with a bunch of other self-help stuff. Just all about, you know, being positive and getting what you want.
We should write a self-help book.
Yeah.
I could write one. It feels like it'd be easy. It feels like it'd be easy to write a self-help book, but really difficult to write a good one.
That's what I was about to say. Exactly. Very much so. Man, my friend growing up, his dad just had like all the Stephen King books. And I didn't read those either because I was too scared.
No, yeah.
And read those until high school.
Oh, man.
Speaking of which, you guys still down to go see It at 4 o'clock today?
Yes.
That's true. What? We're going to go have an adventure. We're going to go see it.
Team adventure. Mm-hmm. I'm going to have to cover my ears.
Has anyone seen it yet?
I have.
Oh.
Sorry.
That's you're on the ball.
You kind did, of person I am.
You did can it. Just you warn me about the jump scares, okay?
No,
okay.
Don't.
Okay. You just give me a sharp elbow to the rib when something spooky
happens. Do you want me to sit behind you and just occasionally lean in and go, here it comes.
Here it comes.
Yeah.
Or we could get that app that's just children laughing.
Oh,
is that
yeah.
an app?
It should be. You're welcome, technology. Or I guess you're welcome, venture capitalists. Sorry, we've gone a little bit yeah. off the rails. Please let us know what you think of it. Obviously, we're excited to go see the film. So – The Power of Positive Thinking, seminal book. In books from this time period, we can discern some of the key recurring elements of what would – we can see the DNA ultimately, what would become prosperity gospel. Speaking the right words, invoking a universal law of success with the words, and having faith in oneself and those abilities.
So a lot of these ideas influenced, among tons of others, E.W. Kenyon, who was an evangelist and the founder of the Bethel Bible Institute. So his particular approach to theology was the basis for one of the prosperity gospel's most particular features, speaking the right words to bring about a new reality, manifesting, you know, what you believe, what you wish to be true. So what you confess, you possess. It's kind of like a reverse version of like the traveler in Ghostbusters, or actually full circle, like It, you know, where the kids see the monster as whatever they fear the most.
Mm-hmm.
This is like a positive version of that.
There we Whoa. Go. I could go with that, yeah.
Good on you, Noel.
Just wanted to bring it, you know.
Yeah. Kenyon is a link to the popular prosperity preachers that form the foundation of the modern prosperity gospel movement. Earlier, we had asked about why this took such strong root.
I'm starting to see it a little clearer now.
And why it flourished. It's quintessentially American and individualist. There's this idea that each person is responsible for her or his own happiness or, you know, whatever their gender might be, and their health and their situation in life, and that applying mental energy in the appropriate direction is in and of itself sufficient to cure any ills. The idea of positive mm-hmm. thinking as a panacea.
But then also bootstraps.
So there are – yeah, I'm glad you said that because there are a couple of other – contributing concepts in play here. There's the
As in like pick yourself up by your bootstraps?
Yes. Yeah. Back when people always had bootstraps.
Yeah.
Those are the little loops at the top?
I honestly don't know.
What are they for?
Are they for
hanging up your boots on a peg?
Yeah, sure.
Yep.
They definitely feel
like
straps.
No, they're for pulling them on.
It's like that
if
new...
If they're at the back, I think you can hang them places right by the straps.
Who hangs a boot? No one hangs a
boot.
I don't
know. Boot hangers, man.
Hey, write in and let us know how you use your bootstraps.
Do you hang your boots or do you just pull them like a tab so you can pop your heel in the back?
Well, what is bootstrapping? Let's get into this
so
concept.
So the idea here is that there are two, as I said, there are two contributing concepts in play in addition to this philosophical concept of mm-hmm. new thought, there's the idea of capitalism. More specifically, the way a lot of Western culture idolizes the Protestant work ethic, so-called. In 1905, a very important author named Max Weber published The Protestant Ethic and the Spirit of Capitalism. And in this, he said specifically that Protestants have a different approach to labor and that this approach to labor is crucial to the development of capitalism and industrialization. He mainly thought about a group that were called the Calvinists, right? And they believed in this idea of predestination, which is a really uncool and depressing concept.
It's the flat circle idea.
How so?
That God – like everything exists and was created as God created it. So essentially God knows who's going to heaven, who's going to hell, like who's going to be good, who's going to be
right,
bad.
You're born damned or saved.
And exactly. No free will, right?
Essentially, yeah. No free will.
We are like automatons that are just set on a path, a predetermined path, and that is all we can possibly achieve.
And we can still get in trouble though. That's also the worst part. If you want to get into the mindset of some of this predestination and just the religious atmosphere of the time, probably some of the most strange and terrifying things to read are old sermons. One of the bangers of this, one of the breakout singles, is a piece called Sinners in the Hand of an Angry God.
Ooh, yeah, and it's a good one.
It's terrifying, right? This sermon contains 10 considerations that are all pretty – oh, pretty much downers. God may cast wicked men into hell at any given moment. Several very specific things about the wicked and the idea that God is like this anti-hero in an action film and is coming for you. And just to let you know how it ends.
Is it okay to spoil this, do you think?
I think so. I think so. It's been out for
a
while.
Statute of limitations. Casey, is it okay to spoil it? Okay.
All right. From Jonathan Edwards, that Sinners in the Hand of the Angry God, it ends like this. Therefore, let everyone that is out of Christ now awake and fly from the wrath to come. The wrath of Almighty God is now undoubtedly hanging over a great part of this congregation. Let everyone fly out of Sodom. Haste and escape for your lives. Look not behind you. Escape to the mountain, lest you be consumed.
Beautiful.
Whew. I know. I don't know if they like pause for a band to play or if everybody just sort of files out.
He goes, ba-da-ba-ba-da-bow, bow.
Well, here's the thing. There are a lot of humans on this planet, even now, that I'm assuming take that very seriously.
Well, and I think the evangelicals in general are sort of the equivalent of like strict constitutional constructionists where it's like the Bible is to be taken pretty literally mm-hmm. and a lot of their tenets come from specific passages, even in terms of tithing, which we'll get into a little later.
Yeah.
And in Max Weber's idea about the Protestant work ethic, he argues that Protestants were looking for outward signs of God's favor, money and material goods, and for ways to express inward virtue, that being hard work.
Where's those bootstraps?
That would be the inward virtue, like
yeah.
working diligently to better yourself shows your inner goodness, and then
your devotion,
right? And then that reward is shown in like you know your physical success.
Yeah, and if you believe that you're predetermined to be good, right? If you are doing good things, it's almost that you have to believe that you are predetermined to be good. So it's this interesting cycle
feedback loop.
Yeah, exactly.
And so today. This interpretation is still the subject of a lot of debate, but it's a popular perspective. And when we come back, we'll tell you about the final contributing thread to the formation of prosperity theology. We've returned. We made it. Did you guys have a good break?
Yeah, it was nice.
Yeah, we talked a little more about Sinners in the Hand of an Angry God.
Yeah.
Which is just, that guy is riding fire there. The final contribution to the DNA of what we call prosperity theology today is the development of charismatic Pentecostal churches in the U.S. This is an umbrella term for a decentralized group of churches. We're talking like hundreds and hundreds of denominations. Over 700, they're characterized by an emphasis on what's known as spiritual gifts or charisms from which the term charismatic is drawn. A worshiper might experience, for example, the gift of faith healing, mm-hmm. right? Or glossolalia,
yep.
which is the fancy dressed up with a tie word.
Everything sounds like glossolalalalalala. It's all the lol sounds.
For speaking in tongues, yeah, right?
So that's mm-hmm. not really true. But I love the word. It's fun to say. When you say glossolalia, if you say it repeatedly, it kind of sounds like you're speaking in tongues already.
Form follows function. It's kind of like ululate.
Mm-hmm. I don't know that one, but I love it.
That's when people go, whoa, 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 whoa. It's a word that describes a very specific sound, like when you go, I can't do it. My throat's a little messed up, but I think it you know, like a wah, 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 wah.
Okay.
That would be it. And nice. Ululation.
Ululations.
Ooh, that was a little high for me.
Yeah. So this, just to get back into this, the tradition of worship in this way, it meant for the believer that God will manifest in some concrete way to the faithful, the people who are worshiping. So you're physically going to have something happen when you're thinking about God and worshiping God in your mind.
Do you have an example?
Yeah, well, those are the examples. The speaking in tongues or running, feeling something
handling
happening in your
serpents.
Chest. Yeah, yeah. Absolutely.
Oh, so like when you see somebody kind of like going into convulsions or
yes,
whatever.
Yeah.
Or like the preacher's laying hands and then all of a sudden they start like, you know, flipping out.
Yeah, God is physically touching you.
So in addition, the decentralized nature of these churches means that there's room for individual leaders to become sort of the focus of personality-based organizations. Many of these officials or preachers might practice faith healing or similar practices, and they would build up these very devoted personal followings. With these three ideas, right, Protestant work ethic, New Thought philosophy, and charismatic Pentecostal preaching, with these three kind of Voltroning and Captain Planeting together, prosperity theology bubbles to the surface. And it started, like the work ethic Max Weber describes, as a way to justify the big elephant in the room of most human civilizations. During the Gilded Age in the U.S., it came around to justify why some people were rich and others, many, many more, were poor.
I love this next quote. We've got an early prosperity gospel proponent, the Baptist preacher Russell H. Conwell.
Huh? Oh, boy.
Get it? No. Okay. A little on the nose. He told his mostly poor congregation in 1915, quote, "I say you ought to be rich. You have no right to be poor."
Why, the very idea, the nerve, running around with no shoes, impoverishing left and right. What's next?
Yeah.
Pick yourself up by your bootstraps.
Exactly. He's punishing, or he's saying that you are being punished because of your failures, not because of some larger structural inequality that's keeping these people in a state of poverty.
And this kind of interpretation, regardless of how you feel about it, it went pretty far and it was pretty well known. God was occasionally portrayed as a banker,
yeah,
dispensing money and material goods to the deserving. And Jesus Christ, to some, was seen as the first and best capitalist. It's a very modern spin on very, very old stories. And it took off in some circles. And today, prosperity theology has a pretty significant amount of support. In 2006, a poll from The Times found that 17% of American Christians identify explicitly, like, yes, I am part of prosperity theology.
That means that there's a good chance that a number of people having this conversation with us and listening would identify themselves in that
way.
Sure.
A little less than 1 out of 5.
Well, that's really great. Later on, we're going to need to hear from you and we'll get to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Because, again, not all churches practicing prosperity theology are the same, or I would even say in some cases remotely related, right? So 31% of the American Christians polled believe that if you give your money to God, God will bless you with more money, and a full 61% agree with the more general idea that God wants people to be prosperous.
However, mainstream evangelicals are a lot of them can't – got to generalize a little bit. They consider this prosperity theology to be a heresy in a way, something not of the true faith.
And why? Here's where it gets crazy. There are a lot of critics.
Yeah.
They don't believe the official stance of the proponents, and instead of seeing them as motivated or motivational religious figures, those skeptical of prosperity theology see these people as essentially con artists.
Conwells.
Conway Twitties.
Did you know in – this is a sidebar. Did you know in Nashville – I think it was Nashville. There was a thing that would spring up, like a seasonal amusement park. It was called Twitty City. And it was Conway Twitty owned it. And they also had the rights to like the Tweety Bird cartoon, you know,
wow,
like the yellow bird.
Mm-hmm. Twitty City.
And they would call it Twitty City.
I thought I put it that.
Wow.
Yeah. Is that the one?
That's the one.
That's the one.
That's a Warner Brothers cartoon. I would think Six Flags would have that on lock.
Yeah, that would make a lot more sense.
Must
than
be some kind of must be some kind of backroom deal going on between Twitty and and Six Flags.
It was a different world back then. I got a camel license there.
Wow!
For some reason, they had a thing where you could ride camels,
like a breeding license
test. No, I got a license to operate a camel.
Awesome.
They did that at the Renaissance Fair. Here, you don't have to have a license, though. That's pretty intense.
No, I was a kid.
Yeah, they gave you a license.
And they're like, oh, here you go.
Oh, it was just a cute thing.
Yeah, I don't think it was. I don't think it would be a situation where we would be later on an airplane or a boat and someone goes, oh, no, is there a camel operator in the house? Please.
Well, you'd have that covered. Before we get too deep into this, I just want to point out that there are degrees of this stuff too, and we're going to talk about some of the extreme ones up front, and then, you know, a lot of this stuff filters into more mainstream kind of accepted religious culture as well, but we're going to kind of start with some of the more extreme ones. And we're not saying that tithing or giving to your faith or giving to your church is inherently a bad thing at all. It's a personal choice, but we're going to start with some examples where I don't think anyone would argue that there is a little bit of ill intent.
Well, there's at least some abuse going on of some sort.
Well, as we said before, you know, as we always say, we're not going to tell you what to believe or interfere with your own spiritual practices. It's a very personal and private matter. And we did say, I think we said earlier in the show too, that these movements are not created equally, and in some cases, what was the language I used? They might not even be remotely related.
Correct.
Right? They believe in health and wealth, but have very different ideas about how to get there.
And to that point, as we said before, a lot of the critics, some of the strongest critics, come from the church. Mm-hmm. Prosperity theology is certainly not a part of mainstream evangelicalism. In fact, evangelicals have condemned, for a large part, prosperity gospels to no uncertain terms. Just for the past few decades even, you'll hear some of the loudest criticism of this stuff, along with its most well-known practitioners like good old Joel Osteen.
Probably one of the most successful religious figures of his sort currently, and caught some bad press recently in the wake of Hurricane Harvey because his staff said that the church was inaccessible due to flooding, and that turned out, of course, not to be the case.
You know, I don't pretend to know the exact particulars of what went on at that church with that thing, but man, it is surprising to see how quickly social media can blow something like that up, where just, you know, a couple thousand retweets and, oh man, Joel Osteen's got to go on the news.
The internet has always been a fickle mistress with capricious favors, right? There's a guy named Gordon Fee, a prominent Pentecostal scholar who wrote a book called The Disease of Health and Wealth Gospels. There's a Calvinist pastor named John Piper who said, the prosperity gospel will not make anyone praise Jesus. It will make people praise prosperity.
It's like an idol you're creating.
Yeah, and there's a Utah pastor named Rick Henderson who said Joel Osteen frequently misunderstands important matters of faith and doctrine, and that last criticism seems to be based more on the nuts and bolts of knowing the Bible, right?
Mm-hmm.
I do also, while we're mentioning books, want to highlight Blessed, A History of the American Prosperity Gospel by Kate Bowler.
Thanks, Kate Bowler.
Yeah, it's a monograph, and it's probably the best work of its kind out currently if you'd like to read more. Secular forces also criticize prosperity theology and accuse it of exploiting the poor. This accusation is a response to prosperity theology's heavy, and we mean heavy, emphasis on tithing. So in prosperity theology, tithing, or giving money to the church, should ideally be someone's first fruits, their initial earnings.
That first 10%.
So if we want to go if we want to be brass tacks about it, a little more specific, then that would mean 10% of your gross income, not your net income. 10% of your pre-tax. So
Uncle Sam comes second.
Uncle Sam comes second. Sally Mae comes third.
Yeah.
Credit card debt. Alimony payments.
Food is down there somewhere.
Mortgages.
Yeah.
Medical debt, which is one of the primary causes of financial personal disaster in mm-hmm. this country. So this money, this tithing, is seen as an investment. By showing faith, parishioners could have a hundredfold return on their investment. And this is a reference to a verse in the Gospel of Mark about those who suffer for Christ receiving a hundredfold what they had lost.
Wow.
In his book, Laws of Prosperity, Ken Copeland writes, "Do you want a hundredfold return on your money? Give and let God multiply it back to you. No bank in the world offers this kind of return. Praise the Lord." From this perspective, tithing is a financially responsible thing to do.
I mean, that sounds like a hot deal.
It really does, doesn't it? It just feels so predatory when you think about people that might be watching a program at a certain time on television, the elderly a lot of times.
But there may also be cases where human psychology is a tricky thing. There may also be cases where people believe this has worked for them.
Yeah.
People think, true. Well, I gave my last $5 as seed prayer money, and immediately afterwards I got that job or that inheritance, or I found the straps on my boots.
Yeah.
And it turns out they work, you know? And it's
– it's also a self-fulfilling prophecy though for, you know, the more wealthy, I would say, right? So if you're like tithing and that's a big part of your mm-hmm. life and you've been doing it for a long time, you could argue that accounts for your continued prosperity and success.
That's
whereas I think that I would be interested to see the offset between donations by wealthy church members versus, you know, more lower class, middle mm-hmm. to lower class members, and how those smaller donations add up and if they equal, if not exceed, mm-hmm. that of the very wealthy contributions.
Yeah,
because I would say, you know, the hook is, I'm not doing so well. I need to give what little money I have in order to do better. Mm-hmm. So it's like you got to spend money to make money, right?
Yeah.
That just checks out. That's just business.
Can I just really quickly interject a personal thing?
Of course.
Going to church as a kid, I would notice, and I wasn't really paying attention to this, but I would notice that a couple times a year there would be a prosperity, just a sermon that was all based on prosperity. And it was all about tithing. It was about why you have to do it, why you should do it, and why you kind of have to do it.
You're
if
Baptist,
you have faith.
Right?
I was Methodist.
Oh, okay, me too.
And then became non-denominational. But it never changed. It never changed. There was always this big push to make sure you were giving X amount of your money to the church at all times.
Well, that's like Pledge Drive Week on NPR.
It's exactly like that, isn't it?
Well, yeah, more ways than one, because the a church depends upon its congregation, right?
Absolutely.
Its parishioners. So, you know, I think there's nothing wrong with having to support that organization.
I guess what I'm saying is that it's so normalized for anyone who has been going to any kind of church for mm-hmm. any amount of time that the jump to prosperity theology I don't think is that far.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Okay.
And that's what I was saying at the top of this section too. It's like there are extreme examples, but these concepts trickle down into more accepted mainstream, like what you're talking about. Mm-hmm. Like I don't think they were pushing that line every day.
No,
but they
no.
certainly wanted to remind you, give you a little kick in the pants,
yeah.
like the NPR pledge drive, you know, that, hey, this stuff doesn't come for free.
Yes.
You know, help us out.
Yeah.
I always feel sorry for the folks on the NPR pledge drives. Toward the end, you could tell they're really feeling it because people who don't write into them all year
mm-hmm.
write into them during the pledge drive going, I can't believe you're doing the pledge drive. This is not what I have my radio on for.
When I used to work for public radio, I had to do little spots like that for the mm-hmm. pledge drive, and it's very specific language. We always had to end them with, and thank you.
Yeah,
it's
absolutely.
Kind of creepy. But like we had like these very strategic meetings where like we had the person that headed up the pledge drive, like helping shape the language for the whole thing and like to make it most effective and all this stuff. Mm-hmm. And the thing they do now is they, hey, help us meet our goal early and we'll end the pledge drive.
It's
yeah,
true.
Yeah.
We're holding the good shows hostage.
That carrot, man.
Yeah,
it's
so,
beautiful.
So we do see this stuff occurring, and that's not the only criticism. There's also a related criticism concerning tax exemptions. This is uh-huh. a real hot-button issue here in the U.S. Like almost any other religious institution in the States, organizations touting prosperity theology do not have to pay taxes.
Wow.
Yeah. One of my favorite criticisms of this was a couple of years back in 2015. John Oliver, on his just fantastic show Last Week Tonight.
Shout out.
Formed the Church of Our Lady of Perpetual Exemption.
Yeah.
Which was entirely stated only to be a church to avoid paying taxes.
Yeah. And it it actually made a ton of money. They were sent all kinds of donations, including some
including jars of semen. You could just say
there
was the actual seeds, and then sex toys, jars of semen, and cash.
Yeah.
And heavily featured in that segment that you're talking about was one of your favorite prosperity theologians.
Yes, that is correct. Creflo Dollar here in Atlanta. Creflo Dollar, a prosperity theologian who maintains that Creflo Dollar is his real and God-given name.
Absolutely.
I just want you to know that he says that is his real name.
Yeah, and he needs those planes, you guys. Send in your money. He needs those planes.
Mm-hmm. So not to get too far into my fascination with this person, but this is a person who made the national headlines in the States when he had a fundraising drive to buy a new private plane for the purposes of spreading the gospel.
Yeah.
There was a previously owned private plane. Their side of the story is that it was unsafe and out of shape. So they're going to buy a new one, right? And he did something brilliant in his speaking, okay? He doesn't ask people to donate. He asks them to believe in God. So he says, you know, I need this many people to believe in God for $50, $150, $250, you know. And then
– interesting.
And then people who are opponents are therefore telling this guy and his parishioners that they cannot believe in God. They're telling me that I can't believe in God for a house, for a car, for a new job. Well, I'm going to believe even more. Now it's time for double X amount of people to give –
$10,000.
Right, or something like that. So that's fascinating. And
wow.
There are stories to the side. Like they say that the plane was unsafe to fly and that they needed the plane, right? Critics also believe that preachers in prosperity theology movement are misusing church funds, squirreling donations away in personal bank accounts, spending money meant for the church on lavish personal items, you know, Rolls Royces, high-end cars, luxury living situations.
But he talks about that. He like hypes up his exorbitant wealth and talks about how he deserves it and barely shies away from the fact that his followers are paying for it. Don't take my word for it. Let's listen to a little sample of Creflo Dollar in action.
Oh, let's.
Proverbs 13, verse 21. Evil pursueth sinners, but to the righteous, good shall be repaid. I'm telling you, this year has been crowned with goodness. And God Almighty has ordained and prearranged for you and I to live the good life. So I want you to get ready. If you're not living the good life, get ready. God says here he's getting ready to repay the righteous with some good.
And Mr. Dollar is not the only one. Let's go back to just one of my favorite prosperity ministers.
You have a favorite too?
He's absolutely my favorite. I grew up with him watching television as a kid before school. His gentleman's name is Robert Tilton. He started out in 74, well before I was born, but he grew his ministry into one of the largest in the country by the 90s. And guess what? He's got a website and still going strong today. He has like a live webcast that he does. I have vivid memories of this guy watching him on TV. He was fascinating. He would speak about all these modern day miracles that could come true in your life. All you had to do was have faith and donate. He would also speak in tongues quite regularly. And he would call out somebody. Like he would.
This was like on regular TV?
This was
like
on television.
In between stuff?
In the mornings.
Like
before,
infomercial time?
Infomercial time before the first commercials come on at like 5 or 6 or something like that.
AM?
Yeah.
Why were you up at 5 a.m.?
My mom was a teacher, so I was at school really early. But I was fascinated by this guy. And yeah. I would just sit there and watch him, and I'd be okay with it before the commercial came on, and I thought it was fun. But the biggest thing he said, or at least I gathered from him and then just reassured myself after looking it up now, is that all your money problems originate with your sins, the things that you're doing. But if you send donations to his ministry, you're going to get those blessings back. I mean, he said it just right out there. He wasn't, you know, playing around with the idea or anything. He just said that. And at the time, his ministry had this direct mailing arm, you might say, the biggest part of it, that would send you items that you're either supposed to touch or you interact with them in some way, and then you send it back to the ministry.
Yeah.
Right?
Yes.
Can you already see, like, what's going on here? Mm-hmm. You send me a miracle prayer cloth. You pray with it. You interact with it. Then you send it back, but you send it back with your faith, your donation. Right? And then you keep that going with people who watch your show. And it's pretty crazy. There were prayer cloths, these little cords they would send you that you pray with again, and then it gets put on some wall of deliverance. There was a hand tracing where if you put your hand on it...
Make it into a turkey?
Well, yeah, you can make it into a turkey, but then you send it back with your donation, and then Robert Tilton's going to put his hand where you put your hand. And you're going to have
really
this connection.
That. I think he had like somebody to do it for him.
Well,
people signing autographs.
Let's get into that, because the interaction was always on you, right? Robert Tilton wasn't sending you a thing that he put his hand on, essentially, or that way. That's a bad example, but you had to send the thing back to them for the interaction to occur. So you never saw it. You both had faith that your donation is going to do something for you.
Double faith,
right? I mean, it was fascinating to me. And ABC News did an investigation in 1991.
Well, I know where this is going.
Well, specifically looking at the direct mailing service, and they found that that alone brought in his ministry in 1991 $80 million a year.
And he wasn't doing what he said he was doing.
No.
Did they find like a giant like pile of hand tracings? And
they looked at the dumpsters in the banks.
No!
Because
oh, wow.
There were numerous banks that were used.
Oh, boy.
And this is all, by the way, I hope I can even talk about this. There were libel lawsuits that ended up getting thrown out and a bunch of appeals and a bunch of other stuff. But they found just tons and tons of fan mail. Gosh, I'm sorry, that's the wrong word. But these letters and the donations and the little objects, the special water that they would send you, it was just thrown away, but the donations were taken, the wire transfers.
You had to buy them in the first place probably, right?
No. They would send stuff to you as like a gift in a way that you would interact with and send back.
But did it directly correlate with your level of giving, like back to the NPR model where you get a coffee cup at one level and then like a tote bag?
Oh, I'm sure some of that existed. I didn't find much of that.
Okay. We'll circle back.
There's more to it, though, we don't have to go into. If you're interested in this whole thing, you can look up Robert Tilton. And you may know who this person is if you don't recognize the name. If you were alive while the internet video phenomenon was beginning, you may remember something called Farting Preacher. And this is the person who's featured in those videos. They can be highly offensive depending on what you believe. They are satirical and, in my opinion, at least as a kid watching them or a younger person watching them, the funniest thing I've ever seen.
I can attest personally, as a 34-year-old man, having never seen this before in my life, when you showed it to me earlier
this
when I
morning,
walked in,
yeah.
I was in stitches. It's amazing. It's amazing. But, you know, buyer beware. It could potentially ruffle your feathers.
Mm-hmm.
Did we mention the scripts that the phone operators were using?
Oh, yeah. That was also in the dumpsters. And in particular with those scripts, it said you're not allowed to be on the phone. Oh, no, they even had a service that would cut the phone off if the person in the call center was talking for more than 7 minutes, because the volume was of such a level that you couldn't stay on the line that longer.
Uh-huh.
And they wouldn't accept any donation below $100.
So if you are calling because you are lonely and you need someone to talk to,
mm-hmm.
they will hang up.
Well, they give you 7 minutes. And if you got $100, you know, you might get on the good graces.
So this you can clearly see in this situation there was stuff that Tilton didn't want you to know, which is that they were not reading it. They were not even, according to their own internal logic, providing the considerations that they said they would.
Yeah, dude, there's so much more to money wasn't going to these what he said he was supposed to have several orphanages in Haiti that apparently didn't exist when ABC investigated. And a lot of the money that was being donated was supposed to go there, but it didn't. And he had numerous mansions, guys. This guy had so many mansions and boats and cars, and it's just really disturbing. It makes me angry.
So he's not the only one, though. He's not the only fish in the shoal here.
No, you still got – here's just another one I threw in here because I think it's noteworthy maybe to younger people who might be listening. If you've ever heard of something called Super Deluxe, which is a thing – it's a video – I don't know, a network, I guess. It's kind of a video network. Mm-hmm. They have a YouTube channel as well, and there's a guy named Vic Berger who is a producer and editor, and he makes these Jim Baker videos specifically about Jim Baker's newest ministry. And he's been around for a long time. You might remember Tammy Faye Baker and Jim Baker. They got into some legal issues. He ended up having to go to jail for a while. Well, he's back, and his most recent stuff is all based on preparing people for what's to come for civilization, like the end times, essentially.
The fall of civilization.
Yeah, exactly, exactly.
Let's hear one of those Vic Berger clips, just to give you a sense.
God gave us a new leader, gave us a new president, mm-hmm. and he says, if we don't occupy it, the enemy will come back in, and that's what they're trying to do. They're trying to kill Trump. They're trying to get him out of office. Kill Trump. Kill Trump.
Okay, there we go. That's a pretty good sample, and people can find it on YouTube.
Well, buckets of food, though, right?
Yes, and if you go on the website, they will accept donations for the following. There's an expanded fuel-less generator package that costs only $3,500. There's also like Noel said, the buckets of food. It's called the Staying Alive Time of Trouble. You can get 32 buckets of food for $1,500. But my favorite, and kind of to see how this whole thing functions, is the complete grocery store special for $3,000. But it has in the description of this item that the value of the food you're getting is $2,190. But you're paying quite a bit more for that. So essentially you're donating to the ministry.
Sure.
And getting something that you will probably use or at least might use.
Is that wrong then if they have the actual value of the stuff?
I was impressed, actually.
No, yeah, exactly. It actually made me feel a little better about it.
Mm-hmm.
But still, you know, he's making money on scaring you into believing the end of the world is on its way, and somehow you're going to be able to be a prepper for this and be okay. I don't know. It still rubs me the wrong way, and Vic Berger is hilarious in his videos, but it's not quite as bad anymore.
I totally agree. I think the transparency and the pricing is interesting and potentially makes it a little less egregious, but when you look at these, they look like a Billy Mays infomercial where
they're totally
like selling you a product. Like it is very much not framed as tithing to the church. It's very much like this is what you need. Buy this to prepare for the end of the world and you only can get it here, folks. So there's that.
So again, it's a matter of degree. You know, it would be unfair to people of faith at large to say that all of these practices or these practitioners are inherently somehow wrong or morally bankrupt.
Yeah.
Several of them, I would argue, are and do have stuff they don't want you to know, but not all of them. We have more examples that we'll return to after a quick word from our sponsors. We have returned. Noel, there was one particular example that you were talking about off air before we stepped into the booth, the room, mm-hmm. cell, the compound.
And yes, this all originated after I showed Noel the farting preacher clip. He showed me a clip of Justin Bieber hanging out at Hillsong? Is that what it was called?
Yeah, Hillsong in L.A. It is a mega church that was founded in Sydney, New South Wales, Australia in 1983 by Brian and Bobby Houston. And it has since expanded across five countries in Europe, Asia, and the Americas. And then it broadcasts online to over 160 nations, has more than 100,000 worldwide attendees, and there are 80 affiliated churches.
Wow.
And so it, you know, when you think of mega churches, you think about this like rock concert kind of atmosphere where rather than like a traditional church, these things take place in like arena type settings.
Oh, yeah.
Thousands and thousands of people. High production value from the actual sermons to the music. It's these like Coldplay style rock shows with like lights and, you know, LEDs and even pyrotechnics and all kinds of bells and whistles. And this is one of the most successful kind of brands, this Hillsong thing, largely because of its association with many celebrities now, especially like the Bieber thing. And there's another super deluxe video with Bieber hanging out with two of the pastors. And there's this part where he's like brushing his teeth while they're talking about stuff. And there's this whole like expand my borders, oh Lord, section, which is great. I recommend just type in Bieber Hillsong. We're not going to bust that one out here. But this is what I was talking about earlier, where it's like, I don't know if I would necessarily peg these people as specifically being prosperity theologians or a prosperity religion, but it's a huge part of it because it's got this inherent flash and, you know, glossy, high production value quality and this sense that, you know, of success that goes along with it with these celebrity affiliations, and they push very hard for tithing. They are Pentecostal, and they are, again, that very strict interpretation of the Bible, which encourages tithing, and they equate that to give 10% of your income.
Of gross income.
Yes, of course, yes, to the church. And, you know, if you look at their site, there is a very robust page for, you know, contributing to this organization. They have a music group, like, you know, like the Universal Music Group, like a record label, basically.
Wow.
Where they put out and make large sums of money, I would imagine, on these Christian rock-type bands.
Dude, I used to listen to this stuff.
Yeah.
Lord,
I lift your name on high.
Yeah.
Lord,
I used to play
that.
I
love
that.
To sing your praises.
I used to play drums for that.
I don't
week.
Think – I mean – I don't think that's inherently wrong.
Absolutely not. I'm joking just, because I was exposed to that. I came from that youth group culture as well, and these songs are forever embedded in my brain, and I resent that a little bit.
Before we get into the bad – the whatever you're about to hit, Noel, I just want to bring that up. But it is an interesting question of when an organization gets this large, at what point does it become just this money-making machine when it's that huge?
Right.
And you could say the same thing about any large church or the Vatican. Remember when we talk about the Vatican Bank and just the money that gets poured into there?
Yeah, and the weird part comes from the tax-exempt aspect of it, where, you know, this is lining the pockets of the founders and the high-level officials in these organizations, and they're not paying any tax on it, you know, and they own massive amounts of real estate. Like in Australia alone, I mean, the value of the property that Hillsong owns is unprecedented. And they even, I think, were trying to enter into an agreement with the government of Sydney to develop a huge area of the city, and it ultimately that didn't happen because like an independent council recommended against it. But we're talking big spending power here and the ability to really shape the politics of a particular area where they hold sway.
Oh, sure. Even beyond it. You know?
Absolutely. Yeah. And I don't want to get too deep into this because I don't think it's entirely relevant to what we're talking about, but I think it's interesting. The father of the founder of Hillsong ran into some legal trouble involving an accusation of a molestation of one of a child in his congregation when he was a Pentecostal pastor. And we won't get too into it here. It's really not particularly relevant, except in the fact that there does seem to have been some influence, perhaps, if you look at the details of the case that could have come from, you know, whether or not it was in choosing to level the accusations or not. The mother of the child made some statements that indicated that she viewed these folks as royalty in this town.
Gotcha.
And there was a sense that we, you know, they can do no wrong. So there's that psychological aspect, maybe not necessarily manipulating the legal system, but, you know, there's a lot of power that comes with being in these positions in people's minds, you know, that are following you. They ascribe certain almost superhuman notions, you know, traits to the folks that are like in controlling these kinds of huge organizations.
Absolutely. And that's not just native to prosperity theology, but to like bring it back there, I would argue that many times that problem is compounded in prosperity theology. One thing we would be remiss about, though, we've talked about, we poo-pooed a tax exemption a little bit, right? Mm-hmm. But there is a reason, and there is a good reason that religious organizations in the U.S. are exempt from paying taxes. It's the least worst answer to a very big potential problem, which is that taxing religions could lead to the loss of freedom of religion.
Yeah.
So what happens if there's, you know, if there's a group of people who have their own private faith and don't have the money to pay for the right to have a church?
Money that would go...
Or the right to practice the religion.
Exactly, and money that would go to the government, right? Which, you know, might make it seem as though there's some connection.
Mm. And ideally, having that separation would keep the, it's like the old Arabic proverb of like, if a camel has his nose in the tent, soon the camel will be in the tent. You know, a slippery slope argument.
All about camels today.
Yeah, I didn't mean to bring it back, but it is a real proverb.
And then obviously you have people that establish, you know, ministries with nothing but good intention, and there is a lot of charity that comes from ministries, mm-hmm. and, you know, philanthropy and helping people in need, giving to the poor. I mean, religion is a force of good most of the time, I would argue.
At the base level,
at its most pure, you know, right. Core.
Be good. Don't be a villain.
Yep.
But I think that there are examples of folks like we're talking about here that maybe look at that tax exemption status as like a way to create an international money machine.
It's an opportunity.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Read about the rationalizations for buying a private jet in a world where 1 billion people die due to lack of toilets.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like in terms of priorities, not having been sent as some sort of divine messenger, it's pretty clear to me that there are other things to spend money on. And maybe, true, maybe people get caught in a bubble with the best of intentions, you know, and the priorities can seem skewed. There is another double standard here, which is that, sure, tax exemption does exist for very good reason. However, as Noel said earlier, it's completely clear that large groups of motivated people in many religious organizations are being told how to vote.
Yes.
Perhaps without knowing an issue, perhaps without even reaching their own conclusion through a spiritual self-guided journey. They're being told that some greater reward, greater spiritual reward, and remember, death can be really good forever, really bad forever in a lot of these belief systems. And that depends on how you vote. That's a dangerous thing for a country.
That's a big voting block, too. I mean, you know, the evangelical vote was very successfully rallied in this most recent presidential election. So there is great power there. And when you start to ask yourself, where are these choices coming from? Who is influencing these choices and to what end? That's a whole nother can of worms that we're not even going to, you know, dive into this episode, but that could be one for the future, maybe.
I think we should look at that influence because we know that it is global, right? Church and state interactions occur in many, many countries.
The roles of churches when there is mass civil unrest.
Sure. Yeah.
Either. That separation we're always talking about is a bit of window dressing, if you ask me.
Often. Yeah, often. And, here, however, we draw to a close with our examination of the ins and outs of prosperity theology. Despite their critics, and there are many, the proponents of prosperity theology, and there are many, seem set to continue this work well into the 21st century. There's an interesting thing. There are booms and busts with this sort of movement. So it was very big in the 50s, right? And it was very big in the 80s. So it may seem to decline or wax and wane over the decades.
I think somebody gets – some figure gets a little too big in the – or too well known, then gets taken down. And then it kind of happens in that way for a long time. It's not a big deal anymore. And then somebody else gets a little too big because nobody's been talking about it. I think that's exactly what happens, Ben.
And now what we're left with is – a question, how much of the money sent to these organizations does go to spread the good word, to maintain and grow a church and religious organization, to support those in need? And how much goes into hidden bank accounts, personal vehicles, clothing, trips, housing, to cover up crimes, right? Based on multiple interviews from multiple journalists over multiple decades, that appears often to be the stuff they don't want you to know.
All right, here we've reached the time where we ask you, what do you think about all this stuff? You know, we spent some time researching it. We've given you our thoughts. What do you think? Is this something that's positive in your neck of the woods? Is it something you've been a part of? Maybe you've got an anecdote of something that came out of working with maybe Joel Osteen. Maybe you work in the church. Maybe, maybe there's something we're missing here.
Maybe you're Joel Osteen's personal page.
Ooh. Mm-hmm. Write to us. We're on Twitter and we're on Facebook. You can find us. We're Conspiracy Stuff on both of those. We're Conspiracy Stuff Show on Instagram. Send us any of that stuff there. Or if you don't like social media, you can find us through email. We get all of our best suggestions for episodes from you, and the feedback you send us on these episodes is invaluable. It really helps us get a better understanding for, you know, what we covered and what we got right, what we got wrong, all that good stuff. If you want to write to us, we are
conspiracy@howstuffworks.com.